My next guest, Donovan Hone, used to be an English teacher with an abiding love for a Melville book with the two-word title, Moby Dick. As I've already warned you, dear listener, he's now written a book with the world's longest title, Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists and fools, including the author who went in search of them. Donovan, what went wrong? How did that clean-living English teacher finish up writing a book with the world's longest and, one might have thought, silliest title?
How did I that happen? Well, I was a writer as well as an English teacher. I did journalism for magazines during the summers, I stumbled upon this little news item about these toys that had fallen off a container ship and gone adrift, and decided I was going to spend a summer writing up their story, and that summer turned into several years.
Let's just do the demographics of what went overboard. 7,200 packs of bathtub toys, each four-piece set, including a blue turtle, a green frog, a red beaver, and a yellow duck. It was the yellow ducks, though, that caught the public imagination.
Yeah, this happened on January 10th in 1992, and the toys began washing up in Alaska in 1993. And after a story in a local newspaper in Sitka, Alaska, the story was carried on to the news wires and traveled around the globe and quickly became the story of the rubber ducks lost at sea.
Now, your wife was preggers when you began this quest, and I know you had quite sensibly hoped you could research the story from home, perhaps, in fact, from the bathtub. But things all changed when you spoke to a gentleman called Curtis Ebersmeyer. Tell us a bit about Curtis.
Yeah, he's an oceanographer, and in his first retirement has become a student of flotsam. He has taken to studying flotsam in general, but in particular that falls off of ships. Whenever there's a spill at sea, and if he finds out about it, he turns it into an accidental oceanographic experiment, using the flotsam as data to study the movement of currents. And he invited me in the summer of 2005. I called him to get details. Really, I just wanted to know if there'd been this rumors in news reports that the toys had crossed the Arctic and would soon be appearing on the east coast of the U.S., and I wanted to know if that was true. And he addressed that question, but he also said to me that you can't go beachcombing by phone. And he invited me to join him on a beachcombing expedition to Alaska.
A life-changing experience. Now, you've developed a great respect for the beachcombing culture, haven't you?
You know, I understand the appeal. There's something about when you find something that's washed up on shore, there's something romantic inherently about it, a sense of it having come from far away, and the mysteries tend to adhere to things you find on the beach. Where did it come from? Did it fall off a ship? Was it thrown overboard, etc.? So it's almost like when you're going beachcombing, you're beachcombing for mysteries and riddles and stories.
We haven't got time to sort of follow the voyage of every creature, but I'd like you to tell us the circumstances under which you scored your own rubber duck in Alaska, because this is a eureka moment, isn't it? This is a beautiful moment in your life.
I had obtained from this oceanographer, Ebersmeyer, a map showing where the toys had been found, but also predicting where they would go. And in the summer of 2007, after I'd quit my job and was following this trail wherever it led, I hitched a ride into the Alaskan wilderness to a very remote stretch of shoreline, uninhabited, hard to get to except by plane or by boat, with a group of perhaps misguided but well-intentioned conservationists who were attempting to remove more than 50 tons of flotsam that had washed up on this one beach.
Forgive the pun, but that's a lot of flotsam.
It is. And it was just, there are certain stretches of shoreline. This is true. You can find them all around the Pacific Rim, all around the world, where the shape of the shoreline and the direction of the currents interact to create these collector beaches. And they're kind of great fun. You can find all sorts of things. But I had, when I set out on this journey, not really expected to find any of the toys. There were a lot of them that had fallen overboard, but there are tens of thousands of miles of shoreline. But this place seemed a good place to look, and other toys had been found, which is why I went there. And it took about 3 days of searching and rummaging, and finally one morning, lo and behold, in the lee of a spruce tree next to a fishing float, was one of these. That was actually a beaver at first. I did eventually get my hands on a duck when I was out there.
Now, you'd be delighted to know that we've done a great many stories on flotsam over the years, particularly on the way the oceans are increasingly clogged with plastic, and this, of course, is the real purpose of the book, leaving jokes about ducks aside. Tell us what's at the heart of the book, your concern about our planetary reliance on plastics.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the heart of the book ends up being an attempt to understand the oceans, and it's part of the reason that the title is a joke in a way, but it also, I was carrying my dog-eared copy of Moby Dick, and Melville's novel is, his narrator goes off to have a look at the watery part of the world, and I was doing the same. And I think now there's no way to look at the ocean without at least trying to reckon the ways in which we've changed it. And the most visible way is in the quantities of plastic that have accumulated. So these toys, if they'd drifted south, some of them certainly would have. They would have south from Alaska towards California. They would have eventually ended up at the heart of what's called the North Pacific Subtropical Gyre, this big circuit of currents that go from East Asia to North America, with Hawaii somewhere around the middle. And as you may have heard, and as you may have talked about on the show, there are quantities of plastic that are accumulating out there. The currents there converge, so whatever's floating gets trapped. And flotsam in centuries past would eventually rot and disappear, but plastic can persist. And we do know that all around the world it's increasing.
You do remind us, however, that even the so-called green plastics made of biochemicals that are meant to degrade release greenhouse gases when they do.
Yeah, they release greenhouse gases when they do, and many of them, studies have found, don't biodegrade in seawater. They have to be in the right conditions. And then, of course, the vast majority of plastics still in use around the world are not those so-called green plastics.
Tell us the most memorable place you've visited, the most interesting single place that demonstrates the crisis. Is it the great mid-Pacific garbage patch, or is it a shore somewhere?
Well, this is the thing. It's sometimes in news reports you've heard the so-called garbage patch described as a kind of a plastic island or a floating junkyard. And when I first heard about the patch in 2005, that's the image that it conjured to mind for me. After all, kind of a patch suggests that. But it's really, in some ways, that's a misleading image. We're talking about tens of thousands of miles of ocean. And some of the stuff afloat is semi-buoyant, so it's below the surface. And all of it eventually breaks apart. It doesn't biodegrade, but it's the sun cracks it up into smaller and smaller pieces. So it ends up moving through the water column a bit like dust through the air. So in a way, the emissions in the atmosphere are a better way of thinking about the plastic in the ocean. When you go out looking for it on the high seas, you really have to go trawling for it. So,
well, I'm glad you confirmed that. Other guests have said that's somewhat hyperbolic. Now, of course, you'd have to do a bit of a crash course in organic chemistry to get on top of this story.
Yeah, organic chemistry and physical oceanography, which is the study of the movement of water, had a lot of patient scientists with whom I had the fortune to travel. But I was going to say, though, in regard to your last question, to really get a visual sense of it, the best places to go are the certain shorelines, the south coast of Hawaii, of the Big Island of Hawaii. There's 9 miles of shoreline where 20-plus tons of flotsam every year washes in, and then we can reckon it.
Yeah, now, we're talking flotsam, but I guess to some extent it's also jetsam, isn't it? It's stuff that's just tossed overboard.
Right. I think of flotsam as the kind of inclusive term, because you often, when you find stuff on the beach, have no idea whether it was thrown off a ship or whether it fell. It's true. Some of it is coming into actually a surprisingly large number of container spills that happen, far more than I realized, and that's one source of it. It's derelict fishing gear that gets lost in heavy weather.
Well, I hadn't realized that much of it is fishing-related. Nets, rope, cones used to trap hagfish, spaces used in oyster farming. There's a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the North Pacific in particular, which is one of the most active fisheries, also is can be pretty rough. So a lot of gear does get lost. That said, the largest source of what's at sea is coming just from watersheds, from coastlines around the world. We can't just point to the fishermen.
My guest is Donovan Hone, and I should tell you that his work has appeared in Harper's Magazine, the New York Times Mag, Outside, the Best Creative Nonfiction Volume 2. He's got a lot of credentials. Tell me about the quite frightening toxins hovering on the surface of the ocean.
Right. So this is increasingly what I appreciated is that although the plastic can be sensational when you see it, part of that is just because it is visible. And there's a great deal, probably the most dramatic ways in which we've changed the ocean are invisible. There's agricultural runoff that's in the water that we can't see, and there are industrial pollutants, DDT, PCBs. I think for decades it seemed that there was an old maxim that held that the solution to pollution is dilution, and the ocean is vast, and so all this stuff would just disappear. It persists out there, and it's a fairly abundant surface. And one way you can know that is that plastic has this propensity to absorb the stuff. So if you sample it and test it, you'll find all sorts of things collecting on the flotsam.
One of the reasons things are collecting is because of large-scale oceanic catastrophes, and I learn a new term from you, and that's post-Panamax, which means that a ship is too big to fit through the Panama Canal, hence long, circuitous routes, often through very wild seas, which can lead to losing cargoes.
Right. Well, the shipping industry has become about maximizing efficiency, and they've discovered that if you have a ship that's too big to fit through the Panama Canal, but is able to carry such immense quantities of cargo, that it's more cost effective to send it on a longer voyage. And the part of the North Pacific where this spill occurred, they're going through what the sailors in the Age of Sail used to call the graveyard of the Pacific, a region of the ocean you'd want to avoid, especially in winter months like January when this spill occurred. And now they've attempted to address to combat those storms with technology, with weather reports, and most of the time it works. I did actually end up crossing the Pacific during the winter storm season on a container ship, just to see for myself what it was like. And it was fairly boring, actually, because it's pretty safe out there. But there's so much cargo being transported around the world that every year there are spills. In the worst case, which is a nice way of getting some sense of it, was a ship in 1998 called the APL China that managed to lose 407 containers on a single very bad night.
You and I have both returned from the Pearl River Delta in China, me quite recently, for a very different reason. But I understand that you traced the origins of the bath toys to the Po Sing Plastic Factory.
Right, which means lucky star, I was told. It's in Dongguan, China, in the kind of industrial outskirts of Guangzhou in the Pearl River Delta. For me, the book does go in many different directions, but there's a fairly simple idea, which was to follow the trail of the toys from beginning to end. And that, by beginning, I had in mind the actual plastic once they'd emerged. So I did manage to locate, through the company that had manufactured them, the factory, and to my surprise was granted a tour and got to see pellets of polyethylene be transformed into yellow duckies with my very own eyes.
Icons of childhood, as the book says. Mm. Donovan, thank you very much for that. I'll now spend the rest of the program restating the title, Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys, count them, lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. Great fun. Great read, published by Scribe. On our next, the last program from our recent trip to China, we're in Shanghai, and I'll be talking about the city's art, history and architecture with a very bright bloke called Jonathan Hutt. And thanks to the team, Chris Short, Muta Tadias, Stephen Crittenden, Sasha Fegan, who's leaving us to have a bub, Paul Goff, Gail Basaria. Next on ABC Radio National is, of course, the news. And let's swell up the lovely music of Elena Katz-Chernin. And I'll talk to you later.